organizing efforts against the Democrat, you know, the... And then organizations, for instance, like Food Not Bombs, which, you know, when we were doing the organizing around the, in January, around the attacks on the homeless and the defense, just did not, you know, didn't get involved and didn't endorse the action. And as a result, a lot less grassroots activity occurred. And there's a lot less, you know, I think that Food Not Bombs was a very big driving force in the radical movement in San Francisco, and now that it's withdrawn its interest in that kind of activity, it's...
Well, what about, Keith, what about homes, not jails, squats, and also this upcoming, is it Proposition L to essentially open the demand that Presidio's weary housing be used for homeless and low-income families?
Oh, well, L, there's a chance that L would pass, and but I think a worse situation is that E would pass. And E would make it more, E is a proposition eviction where what little rent controls are remaining would be many of them gutted, and it would make it possible, much more easy for people to declare that they're owner-occupied apartment buildings, and essentially make it for a majority, it covers a majority of the rental spaces, which are like typically two or three story buildings with flats, and instead of your large apartment complexes, which there's really much less of in San Francisco, and it should increase dramatically the amount of people evicted. And already there was like record number of evictions in the last 12 months. So,
do you expect Proposition E to pass?
There's a possibility it will pass because one. And also, it's probably not the wisest thing in the world to put L on the ballot at this particular election, but to await it until the November election.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason being is typically in January, I mean, the June elections, rather.
More conservative.
More conservative, less people vote overall. And it's not totally clear, my perspective, it seems to me that... more street action is really needed, and not so much a focus on...
Who are the major activist groups in San Francisco now that are engaging in street action? I understand ACT UP is involved, for example, in supporting this, in opposing this, what is it, program by the cookie company up in the Castro?
Yeah, there's. I think ACT UP is involved in that, and Food Not Bombs, maybe some IWW and some Homes Not Jails. I don't know if Eviction Defense is involved in that, or...
There was a lot of organizing around the police commission's hearings around Aaron Williams killers and on the police force, or killer, I should say.
The newest thing in that particular thing is this young woman who was gunned down in her her boyfriend's car and killed. And so that family right now is completely freaked out and not, you know, in somewhat the same way as the early... situation with the Mark Garcia family, or with the Aaron Williams family, or with the Peter Harrigan's family, or with
so they're reluctant to come forward.
But yeah, you know, and you can see like with Sheehan's wife, a widow, you know, she was like terrorized by San Francisco police after they assassinated her husband in at the corner of Golden Gate and.
Well, he was, after all, a drug dealer, correct?
He was potentially a drug user. I think they got that part down, but whether
he was using the wrong kind of drugs. Maybe if he'd stuck to alcohol and perhaps donuts and coffee, it would have had a different outcome.
He might not have killed him right off. That's true.
He might have seen a kindred spirit. I understand McDonald's has set aside a special table for police officers. I don't know if you've heard about that.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised. And there's donut. Other really disgusting things, like there's more of these cameras on all over town for like potential red light runners, but it's really actually being used more, it appears, according to the Examiner and Chronicle and other reports, for things like catching, you know, like whatever, you know, people doing graffiti or whatever you happen to be doing.
What about catching corrupt police officers selling cocaine?
No, they haven't used that yet for that. That could be an interesting
Several years ago, you expressed a lot of concern about National Terrorism Act or Anti-Terrorism Act, which you felt might eventually list Food Not Bombs as an organization. Have your fears been realized at all?
I think that one aspect of that program is the disruption in organizations like Food Not Bombs, in that the $3 million fund for paid informants is, I think it's played a role in why the left in San Francisco is so unable to get organized, unable to really go forward. And I think that there's definitely, that has had a negative effect on political organizing. You know, it's not totally clear in what way exactly, but it just seems if you have like so much energy put towards organizing against left groups, and such a huge budget for paid informants, and then the left itself is like having just a hard time getting going in any direction.
A year ago, Critical Mass was in rebellion against harassment of its monthly ride by the police. Anything new on bicyclist rights in San Francisco that you know about?
The Critical Mass got together pretty good yesterday, I think. I don't know how many people showed up, but they rode out to Sutro Heights. And there was I didn't see any reports of arrests or anything like that, so I think they're still doing it. I know there was, for a while there, kind of a split in people wanting to be more radical and less radical and so on and in that movement, but now that's I don't know, all the original, like the early Critical Masters were all excited about Critical Mass yesterday when I hung out with them, and they were enthusiastic now. I don't think the numbers are as high as they once were because of that arrest July of last year, but at least the enthusiasm seems to still be there.
Now, you were planning to maintain your residence in San Francisco only until early June, when you were going to return to the work on the Amnesty International prisoner of conscience, Leonard Peltier, right?
Yeah, I'm going to, unfortunately, I still am having some more medical stuff around my face until middle of June. I'm probably not going to leave until, the middle of June, actually, to go to Lawrence. And then there is a...
That's Lawrence, Kansas.
Where the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee offices are.
Indeed, also the site of the historic John Brown organization that sparked freedom for slaves and raids against southern states in the 1850s, I might
add. Lawrence is actually a very radical town with a very active free radio station and had a very large October 22nd No Police Brutality Day action last year, and is already organizing towards that action again this year. Lawrence is a surprisingly radical place. You know, you would not expect to find that in the center of almost the exact geographic center of the United States, but that is definitely true. And they have a left, radical newspaper that comes out every month, and many, many speakers and events there. It's a pretty interesting town, and it's also, again, the town where Leonard Peltier Defense Committee's offices are. And so there's a lot of organizing around Native American rights with the Haskell Indian Nation University there, which is the largest Native American university in the United States, and has a lot of that kind of organizing for indigenous people's rights and sovereignty. And the one thing today is I got a phone call from the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee office, and they're very concerned because, Leonard is very, very sick and is in a lot of pain. And as people might be aware, there is a summit happening in Beijing, coincidentally on the anniversary of the day that of the shootout for which Leonard Peltier is behind bars. And on June 26th, there'll be a large protest in Washington, D.C. on June 27th to call for Bill Clinton, the President of the United States, to release Leonard Peltier. And the Chinese government just recently released two of their political prisoners in preparation for this summit to give the United States one less thing to have is their ability to pressure the Chinese government on issues of trade and so on. We're urging the Chinese government to urge Clinton to release both Mumia Abu-Jamal and Leonard Peltier as a good faith gesture to to meet the Chinese government halfway in that matter.
In fact, both those men are the only two officially declared Amnesty International prisoners of conscience currently incarcerated in the United States.
Correct, yes.
And Leonard, right?
Right. Leonard Papierre, as people might recall, a little over a year ago, was sent to a medical facility in Springfield, Illinois, where he was to receive treatment for problems with his jaw. And the medical documents that we received from that procedure included one that pointed out that they directed over 1,000, or they said 1,000 rads of radiation towards his jaw 4 times a day for 1 week. And shortly after that procedure, he increased his weight dramatically and is now, unfortunately, like 280, almost about 300 pounds, and has very bad headaches and dryness of his mouth. And many of the symptoms one would believe were related to radiation on your thyroid, such as fibrosis. Now, medical records that we saw, none of them indicate that the doctors believe that he had cancer of any kind that would require such heavy doses of radiation. Typically, for dental work, the radiation is more in the area of 150 rads, according to the physicians I spoke to, and that 1,000 rads is very unusual unless it is being used intentionally to fight different cancers. And again, there was no indication that the doctors believed that he had cancer. So we're not totally clear why the doctors decided to do this, and then also why they decided to document this, and then also let us have these documents. It's all something that's up in the air. It's interesting that the two political prisoners released by the Chinese government also had medical problems. We're also, in one case, one was a Nobel Peace Prize nominee, like Leonard Papierre, and they were given medical releases and came to the United States for medical attention. And, maybe Leonard could be free to get medical attention in China in exchange. That's something that we're working on, actually, to try to do, and we've got some communications going on with people in the Chinese government to try to urge Clinton administration to do this. So.
Right, well, I know that I read in the papers yesterday that families of students killed in Tiananmen Square have been sued, or have written a letter, not sued, to the government asking that the recompense be given to their families, which, of course, it's a decade later, but I guess it's significant that they're writing. I guess, is there anything more about San Francisco or national homelessness and poverty that you want to talk about?
Let's see. One thing is that I think there is like a broad level of organizing for homeless rights, and even as difficult as things are in San Francisco, I mean, when I've traveled across the country, there was a lot going on. And then in Europe, there was a ton going on. There was the problems that we're facing earlier in California are now like becoming more globalized because of the globalized economic situation. And so that's really, I think, very positive. I mean, young people are organizing for homeless people's rights everywhere. While it might be kind of frustrating in San Francisco, that's by no means like the only place on earth where something's happening or not happening. And I think also that it's like pretty exciting, like the types of things like in Indonesia and so on. There's like I think that to a certain extent there's a lot of signs that capitalism is not having the easy time that was once advertised. And there's a lot of openings for people's movements to really move forward. I think like the nuclear threat and the whole trip that's going on with Pakistan and India is also, while it's very horrible, what's happening is another opportunity really for groups like Food Not Bombs to start coming forward, because, you know, we got our start organizing against nuclear weapons, and
I know that one of our local activists has said that he got rather optimistic about after the Indian nuclear explosion, suggesting that the worldwide hostility to it might provoke the Indian government to break with the IMF and the and the World Bank.
I think that there is a, and I think there's many places where you can see cracks like that. They really would, the people of Indonesia were voting against the IMF World Bank policies, and now the Clinton administration is saying that's the remedy, is more of the stuff that caused the problem in the first place. So I think that there's so much hypocrisy, you know, and the whole trip that went down with Russia, I think in a certain while it's very sad for the people that are facing economic problems there. The fact that capitalism is not really what it's cracked up to be is ultimately the best for the health of the environment and for people's freedom. So the more that there's disasters of that nature, in a certain sense, I think the more hopeful I am. And it's a matter now that activists, I think, instead of necessarily having to organize to bring down capitalism, it's more time where we should really be thinking seriously about what we're going to put in its place, because you know, certainly the capitalists aren't going to put something in its place other than more of the same problems. And it's really those of us who are not into the system to try to really get all of us together and to try to come up with some alternatives and then to really make them happen and make them reality. So,
any concluding comments, Keith?
Well, everyone should send me money, and my phone number is 1-800-884-1136 because we're desperate.
Keith wants your dollars, so send them to him today.
Okay.
And that was Keith McHenry and Carol Denny, activists in San Francisco and Berkeley. We're talking now to activist Adam Welsh of San Jose's Food Not Bombs and also other movements to stop the criminalization of poverty there. How you doing, Adam?
Okay.
And Adam, Food Not Bombs is what, still serving twice a week in St. James Park?
We moved our servings back in around Christmas time to one serving a week, but hopefully since the good weather and more people in the park, we'd like to maybe make two servings a week.
I know at one time San Jose Food Not Bombs was getting, told by police officers that they would have to get a permit or leave, or maybe they would just have to leave, period. What happened with all that?
They say the police haven't been after us for a while. We've seen them in the park harassing people while we're serving in the park. We've heard of like waves of police sweeps in the park because of some newspaper articles that were published in the local paper, which kind of like had some kind of like yuppie homeowners claim to represent like all the residents of the downtown, who say how like the homeless are a nuisance and they want to kick them out of the park.
And they leave needles galore and that sort of
thing. Yeah, which is like total like fabrication.
Sort of the San Francisco hysteria approach that was used last fall by San Francisco Chronicle writer Ken Garcia to prompt a huge attack on homeless in the park by so-called liberal whitewash Willie Brown. I understand that you guys, in fact we covered this a couple months ago, you guys in Food Not Bombs, so you women and men, I might say, wishing to be politically correct, got together and marched to the house of one of the, individuals who've been quoted with anti-homeless statements about St. James Park and the need to, quote, clean it up, and you picketed in front of his place and spoke to him, and you got him to change his opinion, or at least to change his public statements, or?
Well, what he told us was that he felt he was misquoted, and he didn't know that he was going to be in an article which would say things about the homeless. But basically, we think we got message across to him that, one, people don't like what's happening in the park, the residents of the park, the homeless, and that, you know, maybe if he decides to be in an article, maybe he should make sure that he's not in an article that doesn't trash on people and result in people getting arrested and pushed around by the police.
And he was sympathetic to this, or he simply felt somewhat intimidated, perhaps, by your group? Which was it?
I think it was a little of both. I mean, he wasn't so much one of the key members behind his articles. He was just kind of like one of the little pawns, I guess. But there are some big people who are actually really responsible for this.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, because I know in fighting an anti-panhandling law last year that has passed and become law and criminalized, actually not panhandling, it's sitting down anywhere in a 66 square block area downtown, which is now a crime punishable up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine. I particularly was interested in knowing the merchant associations that were behind it so that folks could direct their protest against those people rather than waste their time talking to city council members who
who aren't going to give you anything.
Or who did a done deal. I mean, yeah, and also I think merchants are much more sensitive to high-profile protests because their businesses are involved.
True. And the city council people have nothing to lose, but basically getting the people in these business associations and in these fake homeowner associations, I think that is most important, like you're saying, because we're not going to get anything out of city council or police department because they have no accountability. But basically, these business associations are the people behind it. These are the people like pulling the strings of the city council. So we're like going to the root causes, which is these like, you know, kind of heinous yuppie residents in the downtown who have like a grudge against the homeless and the poor.
Or perhaps just have the idea that it's a better business climate if all these homeless people are driven away, regardless of the implications this has for poor people on the streets.
Well, what they like to say is that they represent the real residents of the downtown, and basically these people have just moved in within the last, you know, couple of years, and the poor have always traditionally been the real residents of the downtown, and especially St. James Park, which is, from what I've heard, since the 30s, my grandfather hung out there in St. James Park, and so St. James Park has been like a park of like the poor, the underclass, for years and years and years, and then these people have just recently come in and said, well, we want to make a park for everyone, which is basically like the code word for putting in things that they like, and they claim that's not an active use park, and that they want to put like putting greens and petting zoos and volleyball courts and stuff like that.
Water polo grounds.
Yeah, they want to put things that will attract yuppies into there, and that will appeal to them. But St. James Park is probably the most used park in like all of Santa Clara County, because people are in it every day, people hang out there all the time, and then there's like a community of people who hang out there. And I don't think I've ever seen that in any park, except for maybe People's Park. And so...
In Berkeley, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's... People's Park is about as close as I've ever seen when it comes to St. James Park. And then these people want basically their things in, and then that would mean pushing out and kicking out the residents who currently occupy it and use it for community purposes.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily see a necessary conflict between adding additional sports facilities and, you know, traditional use if there wasn't really an underlying agenda to get rid of poor people and homeless people. But it seems like that may well be the agenda. I know up in Berkeley a lot of people opposed the so-called volleyball court and the attempts to add sports courts to that area because they felt it was an attempt to eliminate the park as a political factor and gathering place for poor people. There was a stage there and so forth. I guess you also have a stage in St. James Park, right?
Yeah, there's kind of a podium.
Uh-huh.
True that there's like, just yesterday, a No on 227 march from De Anza Junior College. They marched from their college into the downtown, and they wound up in St. James Park. So St. James Park is kind of like a political place and does have like a community of poor people who hang out there. And I do think that these are their attempts to push them out, not only because these represent kind of like the takeover of their space, because people hang out in the grass because it's open and you can lay on it and it's nice. But if they put volleyball courts, that means less space for sit down and relax and talk.
It's also sort of a progressive movement against poor people in the area, as exemplified by at least three different things. The Cesar Chavez Park was fundamentally turned into a kind of a closed commercial park, right?
Yeah, now they have things like, speaking of Cesar Chavez Park, an ironic thing is, like, they kicked the homeless out of Cesar Chavez Park and made it into, like, this really boring, empty park now. And yesterday they had this thing, I can't remember the name of it, but it was a benefit for Envision, which is, like, the corporate city-funded shelter business or agency, whatever you'd like to say it. It was a fundraiser for them, and although it was free, you had to buy tickets, and then through the tickets, then you got to go to all the downtown high-scale restaurants and try out their cheeses and wines. And so this was kind of like...
an annex to the merchant center in downtown San
Francisco. Well, it was a benefit for them because this gets people to go to the businesses, but basically the irony of it is that they claim that this is good and for charity and it's a benefit for like the shelter agency, Envision, but in order to get that festival to work, they had to kick out the homeless who used Cesar Chavez Park like a couple years ago. So it's funny how they kind of like kick out the homeless, and then in the space that they kick out the homeless, they have benefits supposedly for the homeless.
In order to save the homeless, they had to remove them, yes.
Yeah, precisely.
Right. Cool. Well, of course, what they're doing is similar to Real Change, Not Spare Change program in Santa Cruz, the Dolphin program in Santa Monica, the new program in San Francisco, and the CAST district give a hand, not a handout. They're encouraging people to sort of strangle and starve the homeless in terms of not giving them money in order to remove them from the area, you know, in the somehow, well, the main objective is to, you know, establish a homeless-free zone where people can imagine they have a sort of a suburban, homogenized, secure environment without the uncomfortable reminders of what's really going on around us economically, and without respecting the rights of poor people that they have to, you know, will have to brush as they pass every day.
Well, basically, that's really true, because in San Jose, you see the same things. They want to remove the homeless out because they're an eyesore, because they want everyone to come downtown and shop and consume. And they don't want people to realize that this is the result of all this consuming and shopping and of this society that there's and idea of, you know, buying. Basically, they want people to think that capitalism and expanding markets and stuff like that, making downtown into a yuppie thing, will have no effect.
Sort of the Indonesia solution.
Yeah, basically, they don't think. They want people to ignore that when they move all the office buildings and yuppie shopping centers into the downtown, that the result is all the poor people who currently live downtown are going to have nowhere to go but the streets, and so that's going to increase the homeless. And they just want people to not notice that what they're doing, because it's like a total cause-effect relationship.
So, as I said, in San Jose, I've seen first this anti-sitting law come into effect last year. Well, before that, Cesar Chavez Park closed off, fundamentally. I mean, is that in fact accurate? Do they close it during the day, or is it open?
It's not closed, necessarily, but nobody hangs out in it, because the police, I think they revamped the park, and basically when they revamped the park and refurbished it, they kicked all the homeless out because they said, well, we have to do this construction. And then once they finished construction, the police have, like, basically put the message out that, well, you can't hang out here anymore. We've done this park. It's a nice park now.
And ironically, of course, parks are one of the few places that the mayor and city council have made it legal to sit down. You cannot sit down on the sidewalks. You cannot sit down in any other public spaces unless there are seating areas or bus areas, or unless you are in an emergency situation or gravely disabled, like in a wheelchair or something. So they have, in essence, they're really saying, go sit down on the outskirts of town. And this was the message that, of course, was being given out in St. James Park, as I saw it, when police were going after Food Not Bombs, what, 6-8 months ago. And it was the message to the Community Homeless Alliance Ministry when they were housing homeless people in their church, which is somewhat downtown on 5th Street. And they were told, no, you can run a warehouse on the outskirts of town throughout the winter as a sort of a teeny tiny shelter, but don't try to house them in your church downtown. Don't have homeless people downtown.
Yeah, in fact, there's a law that's saying that any new shelters, you can't build any new shelters in the downtown. They won't allow it.
Is this a new law or an old law?
I think it's not a new law, but it's been around, and that means so that when, say, Envision or any of the other shelter agencies or groups that may think of providing a shelter, they only want them to provide it on the very outskirts and outside the downtown.
Now, we're talking to Adam Welsh, San Jose Food Not Bombs activist. And I wanted to tell you also, Adam, when I was passing through town heading for Sacramento for a homelessness and housing conference, we stopped at the Community Homeless Alliance Ministry, who was organizing, I think, a potential housing takeover of abandoned or unused space to encourage the redevelopment agency or whatever other groups are sitting on money and vacant property to release shelter and housing, affordable housing for people. And on the car window, when I returned to my car, I found this scurrilous publication, Mob Rule.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, I'm being somewhat sarcastic. Mob Rule looked like an excellent and interesting kind of local critique of the city and its anti-homeless policies, particularly the so-called COPS grants, and sort of new sort of neighborhood snitch informant networks and how that works. And then now I'm leading, you were telling me before we were on air here that
or Food Now some Food Now Bombs folks have been kind of investigating this process of kind of police involving the neighborhood in a kind of an anti-homeless network, or a network of groups that is essentially kind of a para-police organization. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? And
sure.
About Mob Rule, the publication that's been put out by us, by one of your members?
Yeah, Mob Rule is basically like a street magazine that's come out of the street and like squat and homeless and just art scene in San Jose. And it basically exposes and attacks the, in words of course, the policies and some of the things that the city has been doing, and then kind of reveals them for what they are. And one of the important things, first issue, it talked about, of course, that the guy who put that had the quote in the newspaper, and we went to his house, it talked about that and what happened there, and how that homeowners association that this person claimed to be from is not really, it's just a few people who are really the upper class residents who are trying to kick out the lower class residents of St. James.
Now, was this organized by them or by the police department?
This group is basically, we found out that group that they claim to be from, is that they are organized by the police department, and what the police would do is they knock on people's door and they say, well, we're looking for residents who are concerned on crime, and we're going to have a neighborhood meeting about it. And basically, this is kind of a thing to get either upper-class residents, because the lower-class residents know that the problems in downtown aren't really centered around crime, but they're pretty much against the police because they know, you know, of the police brutality that happens in the downtown. And in this, they try to appeal to, like, the upper-class residents or, like, the really confused working-class residents. And and then they get them to a meeting, and then they get people who they think, you know, will work with their program, and they get them to form a neighborhood organization. And what they'll do is they'll, like, cut barriers of red tape for them. Like, if they want, like, a street light repaired or, like, a sidewalk fixed, the police will, you know, pull strings for them so that they can get that fixed really fast, and they'll do things for them. And so, basically, these neighborhood organizations are there to try to, like, raise property values. And that's what they're there for, because raising property values helps the not only these upper-class residents who may own property themselves, but the police also, because that basically raising the property values raises the rents and makes it unable for poor residents of downtown to live there.
Now, isn't it true that this sort of is also a self-perpetuating, somewhat incestuous process, because police get money from federal sources to encourage them to do this program, and then perhaps the more they're able to be successfully do these programs, the more money they get from the feds. Is that accurate or not?
I'm not sure about that, but I do know that the city governments and have given these neighborhood organizations and the police, like, I think somewhere between like $100,000 and some other people like $1 million to revitalize St. James Park, and it is in their plans to kick out the homeless there. We went to the business association meeting of downtown, and they said how they planned on kicking out the homeless. They talked about
this was about a year ago.
Yeah, this is about a year ago. They talked basically about like what is their strategy for doing it, and basically they defined their strategy as they want to revitalize it and like put in these things like, you know, tennis courts or whatever, and they want to use that as a plan to displace the people in St. James Park.
In Santa Cruz, there are similar plans that have anti-homeless architecture and the building of new parking structures that will disallow loitering, as they call it, or sitting or lingering. And also in Santa Cruz, as talking again about these neighborhood groups and organizations, we have organizing from previously liberal or progressive politicians like Scott Kennedy and his protege Eric Larson in the south of Laurel Beach Flats area, where they are seeking money, grants, for example, groups that were pretty much independent of or even opposed to police solutions, like the Resource Center for Nonviolence, and now they are working with the police in order to deal with so-called gang problems. But actually, you know, it has a much broader significance in terms of co-opting these kinds of groups and involving them in, again, the receipt of money like Department of Justice COPS grants, which is, you know, money that comes to the police department if they can, in essence, infiltrate the community and involve the community in their police process. Has anything like that happened in San Jose?
Yeah, that's Project Crackdown. That's basically the San Jose version of that.
That's actually the name of it, Project Crackdown?
Yeah. in San Jose, basically, it's Project Crackdown started after the L.A. riots and around, like, a little after 1992, where the police realized that in order to keep control of the poor people, that they can't do it unless they make it appear as if they have some community support or some people support them. So what they do is they form these Project Crackdown groups and neighborhood revitalization things and neighborhood associations, and then they say that these groups, which are actually like really conservative residents, upper-class residents, or youth people, and they tell them that, well, we want to revitalize your neighborhood and make it better, and so they get them to do things like graffiti cleanup and, you know, repainting fences and all that. Although that sounds good at the community level, but the purpose of these is, like I said, to raise property values and get these people to identify with the police and, in a sense, by giving them grants and getting them to participate in police programs like graffiti cleanup, they get them to cooperate and participate with the police. And so that's that's what Project Crackdown is. And it also is where the police get all their forces and they centralize them in one area to kind of like push everyone out of this one small area, like a couple blocks.
Now, what areas has this been done in so far?
I know there's certain neighborhoods in the downtown, but I'd have to look in Mob Rule. It talks more on these things.
Now, Mob Rule, of course, is the publication we were talking about. And how many issues of this have come out so far?
Two so far.
And how can one get a copy of this publication?
Well, basically, it's kind of anonymously published, so it's unless you're like frequenting the downtown and some of the places there or talking to some of the people there, it's hard to get. But I have a couple copies, so if you write to Funat Bombs, I can send you a copy because I have some extra ones.
And what is the address of San Jose Funat Bombs?
Well, our address is changing right now. We're getting a new post office box, and so you'll have to write to just my address, my personal one.
Well, let me do this. Let me give folks who are interested in receiving a copy of this my phone number. You can call me and give me your address here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. And I will pass that address on to Adam here at San Jose Funat Bombs, and he can send you a copy. Is that a possibility, Adam?
Yeah, that sounds like that worked better than giving out my personal address.
Right, and so for those who are interested, give a call to 423-4833 or 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F. And if you're interested in a copy of the San Jose radical publication, Mob Rule, very good publication, very interesting, and in the future show, I'm hopeful we can actually maybe even get the author anonymously, of course, on the air. I think if the author also may be writing for Street Spirit, the upcoming June issue. Street Spirit may have a story about San Jose from her or him. Anyway, gosh, Adam, I appreciate all that.
Another thing I'd like to talk about before we go, Mob Rule, and this little magazine has sparked like a lot of controversy in the downtown, and not only has it kind of, in a sense, done to homeless to kind of realize how these forces are at work against them, but it's basically pissed off to the police to the degree where they're handcuffing people and grilling them and threatening them in order to find out the identity and get to the person who puts it out.
Have they found her or him yet?
Well, they had one run-in, but they didn't wind up getting them.
Do you have any specifics about, you think people are actually being arrested and asked about this publication, or?
Well, one person that we know, he was riding his bicycle through the downtown, and he's the publisher of Mob Rule, and basically, the police stopped him, and he wasn't doing anything wrong. They said he wasn't wearing a helmet, but of course, he's over 18. The laws don't apply to him.
Helmet in terms of a bicyclist, right?
Yeah, he needs. And then so they pulled him over, they took him off his bike, and they handcuffed him, and then they put him up against the wall, and then they grilled him like, you know so-and-so, does he put out Mob Rule, where can we find him, what car does he drive, where does he live, you know, where does he hang out? And they told him that they would arrest him unless he gave them the, unless they told him where he was.
And what was the response of our bicyclist?
Well, he was scared because he was, you know, he didn't want to get arrested. Didn't want any trouble with the law. He told them that he'd give them pager number, and so his pager number doesn't work anymore, and so they won't find him.
Mm-hmm.
And through that, And they've also leaps through the park and talking when they harass people as usual, instead of just telling them and giving them tickets for the usual stuff. They say, who writes Yellow Magazine, or who writes this Red Magazine? Who's Rob Banks? That's one of the pseudonyms that was in a mob rule.
Mm-hmm.
Who writes this? Where can we find him? And they're threatening them with tickets. So the police are after the author of Mob Rule, and they wish to meet with him, perhaps? I don't know.
Maybe they're just simply interested in a friendly chat.
Yeah, possibly a chat with their billy clubs.
Well, yes. They're all, you know, a little disciplined can sometimes be very stimulating.
Well, probably they're just out to, like, intimidate him and harass him into not putting it out and not distributing it anymore, because it is basically, it shows how the police are basically cooperating in this, and the police are basically not in the interest of the people, but are actually just following kind of the orders and what these upper class and residents and what the businesses want them to do. And it also talks about, like, police brutality that has happened to the homeless.
Any reports on that before we go?
One person was, they were in, like, a knife fight, and then they had it, like, everything was happened because the other person took the knife from them, but when the police intervened, the person that we know, Gracie, she who took the knife from the attacker, and so everything was calm after that, and then they're, like, leaving. The police jumped on her, and then when they tackled her, they, like, knocked her head into, like, a hole, mm-hmm. like, kind of, like, pushed her around and, like, pushed her up. And
How is she now?
She's doing pretty good. She's, like, 16 years old, and so she's having, like, a little bit of a tough time, but she has some, her brother is also, like, on the streets with her, so I guess she's doing pretty good.
Now, what about this woman, I guess, mentioned in a Mob Rule article who was taken by the police, Mama, what's her name?
Mama Faye.
Mama Faye. Is she, I understand she was taken after a story from her appeared in a local paper, critical of either the police or the Downtown Association or police practices in St. James Park. Is that accurate? Or?
Yeah, that was published in the Metro, which is kind of like this alternative newspaper
mm-hmm.
in this area. And basically, it kind of talked about her and how she's kind of like a figurehead, but like a key person in the St. James Park community. She always hangs out there. She always, like, will carry people's stuff, and she had, like, food give away, because lots of people would come to the park and give her stuff, like clothes, and then she'd give them out to people who needed them. So everyone knew her, and everyone liked her, and so she was, like, kind of a big person. She'd been called the mayor of West St. James Park.
She's a black woman?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, the police had, like, arrested her before and taken all her stuff. She has, like, a couple shopping bags and carts, like, kind of like...
What did they arrest her for?
Excuse me?
What did they arrest her for?
I'm not sure what they arrested her. Probably just for, like, littering. She had all those stuff and having shopping bags in the park, I think. I mean, shopping carts in the park, which I think is illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And so they stole all of her stuff. And then a couple of weeks later, after this article was published talking about how she's kind of like part of the St. James Park community, and I think she had a couple of quotes in there that talked how the police were harassing people and harassing her and took her stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the police arrested her. And then, as you may or may not know, when the police arrest somebody, they
5150'd her, right? They put her into a psychiatric hold.
Yeah, they can judge the sanity of any person that they arrest just on their word. And they can declare them insane just on simply because they think so.
Actually, the reality is they are allowed to hold someone and take them to a psych ward, but at a psych ward, a psychiatrist makes a determination as to whether a person can be held for 72 hours for observation, and that can be done on the basis of three different criteria. One, is a person a danger to herself? Is she a danger to others? Or is she gravely disabled? But the police officer himself doesn't make a ruling on sanity or on mental illness, except so far as to say, preliminarily, they believe that an individual is sufficiently dangerous to themselves, to others, or gravely disabled to require them to be taken into a psych ward. But the person who makes the decision about holding them there is the psych official.
Well, heard. Basically, she was put on the 8th floor, which is like the insane ward of the county jail.
The psych ward?
Yeah. And,
And you are tuned to Freak Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3. Very interesting interview there on Robert Norse's show, Civil Rights for the poor, bathrobes, beers, broadsides that you can hear every Sunday after the hour of slack at 11 o'clock. And you can also hear Robert Norse on Thursdays from 6 to 8 before Earth First Radio here on Freak Radio Santa Cruz, your uncorporate, uncommercial, crazy fucking pirate station. This is Reckless, and we're about to begin fucking it up in a fuck society with music and issues for brainwashed children. Been talking to people on the streets, been reading the newspaper, been hearing what's going on around town. Want to talk a little bit about that. Got a fucking great show lined up. Let's fucking play some music and shit. Call in. Go ahead, fucking check out. Been talk a little bit about brainwash. I want you guys to know to stay tuned. After my show, Utah Phillips, Alternative Radio, and then we have a special thing with Dan Hamburg, gubernatorial candidate, and then, of course, the ever-infamous Clatterbox at 7 on Freak Radio.